Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com.
Tobias Carlisle is the founder and principal of Acquirers Funds. For regulatory reasons, he will not discuss any of the Acquirers Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquirers Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquirersfunds.com.
That apparently we are streaming.
Buffering. Live.
Yeah.
Well, it's 10:30 a.m. on the West Coast, 1:30 p.m. on the East Coast. No idea what it is, UTC. Sorry, amigos.
Ooh.
We are back.
Back indeed. The trio.
I missed you guys over the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, likewise. Missed everybody.
I also missed you guys. I'm happy to be back and in the swing of things. It was a long month of raging.
Partying?
Yeah, I did. But I don't know. Somebody, I think it was Churchill. I'm not quite certain who it was. But said that the reason that they were able to work very hard is that they worked 11 months a year. And I kind of like that. I like extended breaks. I think it was a good...
That was
helped me get in the right headspace. I don't know. I mean, what the fuck do I know? I'm just throwing out random stuff that I agree with and attributing it to the wrong people.
Put that on a picture of a sunrise and put it out on the internet.
That's right, man. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and the philosophizer.
Yeah, that should be on a coffee cup already, even if it's wrong.
Especially
if it's wrong.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and then you just like attribute it to somebody famous, right? And then you can sell it. I think that's how it works.
He's got that quote about being able to find any quote on the internet. That was one of Churchill's.
On the internet? Wow.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like
way
that
ahead
one.
Of his time.
He was a visionary, sir, much like many growth investors.
Ooh, yeah. Already. So what do we have on topics today?
I'm going to defend Charlie and the CCP, so we'll see how that goes.
Okay.
We've officially already been demonetized.
Automatic. Demonetization check.
This might just go dark. This whole
yeah, they're just gonna just shut us down. Yeah, I like it.
Okay.
I got value guys after crawling through the desert for the requisite biblical period of time and then a little bit longer. Had this like brief like 2 minute, 2 day rally and then back into the desert. And so
just like their sex life.
Oh,
sorry. So I've got
how dare you?
A cool drink of water, just to confirm the prize, to keep everybody going. Little mirage, so you can keep on crawling through the desert. Maybe there's a lagoon up ahead. I don't know. What do you got, JT?
I'm gonna ease us back into the veggies. Nothing, not too hard. Hardcore science with actually a little segment on cooking. French cooking, to be more specific. So we'll see if I can torture some analogies out of that.
You know what I like? Shout out, we got a listener in the house that goes by the handle the Buff Dog. Much appreciated. I wish that you were actually the real guy.
In Chi-Town.
Maybe
it is. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, maybe he took NetJets over there. Can I start by defending Charlie?
Yeah, let's go there.
I think that's the best way to start.
Just in case
show.
We get shut down, yeah. And I can it'll free up the rest of my hour.
Yeah, there you go. So I think fundamentally, Charlie has said stuff about China that makes me uncomfortable as someone that prefers liberal democracies. And I don't mean liberal like, you know, our political leaning, right? But like
capital L.
That's right. However, when he was asked about Jack Ma and when he said that China did the right thing, I think what Charlie meant is like within the confines of the system that they play in, the way that they handled it made sense because you like their rule structure is not one that you can expect to speak out about and be okay. But I don't think he's advocating that like that's not his preferred rule structure. I just think the way his mind works is like, those are the rules of the game. So of course you implement, like that's how you play the game once those are the rules that are established.
What did he say?
He basically said like locking Jack Ma up was fine. And then
he
said,
up?
Well, he disappeared for a while. I mean, I don't know what the hell happened. You tell me. I mean,
getting treatment for an addiction.
Yeah. He had a secret coke addiction and he went to rehab for a month. I don't think that's the case.
He's getting reprogramming like Clockwork Orange style.
Now, he did go on to say, like, I wish that our system could do something like that in certain financial matters.
Re-educate people.
I mean, yeah, probably Charlie wouldn't be too undone with that. But I'm just saying, like, I think that he is sort of like, I do think he's obviously got a soft spot for authoritarianism when the end is
very effective.
Yeah, well,
I get shit done.
That's right.
The and trains like, in Nazi Germany ran on time.
Yeah, well, I think what Charlie would argue is that China has lifted so many people out of poverty that in that instance, he's comfortable with the means to get to the end. I'm not going to defend that, but that is what I interpret him to say when he speaks about China. And then given that, you can't speak out about him. If you're the guy that was allowed to have Alibaba thrive, you can't get to the point where you think that you're above the government and all of a sudden start criticizing him. Like, that's just not the rules of the game.
What happened? What did it spring from? Wasn't it? I thought that
Ant Financial.
Yeah. So there was, this is, I don't know anything at all. This is totally peripheral. Something that I read a long time ago. I thought
you're
there was some
so getting deplatformed.
Yeah, maybe. But I thought there was some issue that Ant Financial was sort of spun out of Alibaba. And there were some insiders who sort of collected a big shareholding in it on the way out. And then when they went to list it, the regulator said too much. So that's one version. The other version is that the internal, the financials weren't sufficiently tight, or they weren't tracking it well enough.
I think Jack Ma said, "I know how to do this better than the government," and then he disappeared for a while. Because he went on a vacation for a minute after he spoke out. So what that vacation looks like, I don't know. That's kind of where you have to that's kind of what Becky Quick asked, right? She was like, "Do you think they handled Jack Ma correctly?" And Charlie basically said yes.
Wait, hang on.
Can we agree that that's what happened? Like, Jake, is that your understanding of what happened?
The conversation or what happened to Jack Ma?
Between Becky Quick and Charlie.
I've watched it a few times and I still not quite exactly sure what Charlie was saying that he was okay with or not okay with. But I think in general, we can probably safely zoom out a little bit and say that let me back up a little bit. I think so if you've been studying human folly your whole life and you recognize errors pretty quickly, and maybe you're even a little biased towards like error recognition, I think that can set you up to be more open to a nudge style approach to how governments and humans and interact. And, you know, I look at his praise of Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore, and, you know, like that was there's a fair amount of nudging that happens there in how they run things. And it's probably for the better in a lot of cases in how people behave and saving for their retirements, you know, automatically. And there's just a lot of things that they do there that are don't fit with our kind of Western individual, don't tell me what to do ever kind of mentality. But you could see Charlie, I think maybe recognizes where that can produce errors like it does, and that maybe he's okay with more nudging than other people might be. So preface all that as the prepackage of, I think that he's okay with the Chinese government being a little more heavy-handed than other governments because of the system that they're running and that trying to maybe do what they think is best for the majority of the people. I mean, I don't know. These are really like complicated and difficult questions to untangle.
So I'm a Becky Quick fan. But
I think she's terrific. Like she handles them better than anybody.
Yeah, but he deserved a follow up there, and like a really like precise one, because I think she kind of walked him into a trap and then didn't open the door for him to speak his way out of it.
You say that as someone who got smoked by Charlie at the Daily Journal meeting that didn't let him off the hook easily.
Well, I had already sat down with you, sir, and sitting in board shorts was not exactly the best way to push back on Charlie. But yes, I know how a question to Charlie can turn around on you. And yeah. I wish that I had followed.
I got a comment here, which is kind of interesting. Like, Michael Burry is open on Twitter, and he gets a visit from the SEC, and then he sort of disappears from Twitter for a little while. What's the difference?
That's Twitter.
Well, we don't know. We don't really know what happened to Jack Murray. He might have just been at home, like not tweeting for a little bit.
Yeah, it's not possible. Commenting. Maybe he just went to the Turks and Caicos. I'm sure vacation. It was a nice vacation.
He can afford it.
Yeah, there may not be a difference. I don't know. But I think that one of the things that could have been structured a little bit better about that discussion is maybe they could have framed in what happened to Jack Ma, right? How did China deal with Jack Ma, and had a follow-up to the question? Because I do kind of think Charlie was led to a place, gave an answer, and probably deserved a follow-up or two.
What about more broadly, like just investing in China? Munger's sort of, he found Li Lu however long ago, 10 or 20 years ago, gave him $1 billion. Li Lu, as a result, is now a billionaire, but he's not just a billionaire and that's it. That's not the end of the story. He's turned the billion that Munger gave him into whatever it is, 6 or 7 or more. And so Munger's got some interest in seeing, you know, probably he thinks that it's the next little period of time, decade or so, is China's. So he's set up the Munger family for a period of time by getting a great deal of exposure to China. What do you think about that as a strategy?
Is it really a great deal of exposure? I mean, it's like one position in Daily Journal and the majority of his net worth's in Costco and Berkshire. So I think it's important to contextualize that. Like how much, to me, I always think about like, what's the real bet here? How does it really impact him? And what does it really matter? And like, if Daily Journal is eviscerated from the earth, I'm sure Munger would like rather that not happen, but that's not the entity that's going to, the Mungers are not dependent upon the Daily Journal. And I think that like, if you're Charlie, one, I think Alibaba could make some sense to you. Two, Li Lu is his advisor. So like, that's way smarter than me on this particular topic and almost all, other than maybe life happiness. I might, but I don't know Li Lu. He's probably a happy guy. What's up, Lee? Thanks for listening. I just kind of think like if you're Charlie the teacher, it's an important signal to send that your last bet is on something like Alibaba. You know,
last bet. Come on, he's got lots of time.
He's a man that thinks in statistics. It's not like that far out to say he doesn't have more than 4 or 5 more years left.
I mean, that's been the case for a little while now, right? That hasn't stopped him from
I hope
investing
he continues to be the outlier.
He's not going to day trade now because he's got to close out those positions.
Right.
Yeah.
Got to close out before the close every day.
I think it's a reasonable conclusion that maybe this is one of his last larger bets. Maybe not. I hope not.
What about for the rest of us, China as an investment destination?
I don't mind it as part of the portfolio. I'm not going to like go throw 30% of my net worth in it. Like I don't know, 3-5%. Like it seems like a reasonable way to get some exposure to, but I don't have like a strong opinion either way. I don't think China can just like fuck over outside investors and end up in the place that China wants to be over the long term. It seems like you're cutting off your nose to spite your face.
There have been some incredible returns out of China. There are these companies that pop up in a very short period of time. They're stupendously huge.
Yeah. I don't know how to underwrite it. I don't know that I trust the accounting. I don't know any of that shit. But if it's 3%, it goes to 0, that's not going to kill me. And if you actually can own a compounder that can compound for years and years and years, I don't think it's like a patently stupid move. I just... kind of depends on what you're comfortable with.
We've all got home country bias where we just allocate way too much to our own country. And, you know, we're in a position where I like that slide that Buffett put up at the Berkshire meeting where he said, you know, 30 years ago, it was Japan was dominant and there are a handful of American companies in there. Now America's dominant. There's a handful of Chinese companies in there. I don't know whether this was his implication or whether this is like, this is a possibility, but there's got to be a reasonably good chance the next 30 years it's full of Chinese companies and there are a handful of American companies in there.
Yeah.
I think India too, right? Like I don't know anything about India. There's people have told me like, you know, there's a lot of corruption over there, right? Okay. Well, I don't know how to invest there, but if people want to invest there, I'm sure A, there are people that know how to. Shout out to the homie Ramneek. And then two, like, I don't know if you want to put something in it, I get it.
I will say that I've heard, and I don't know exactly how to verify this, but in China specifically, that like 70 to 80% of the equity holdings are held by mom and pop, like retail type of investors. So perhaps in the game of, you know, with this that we're playing in the US where there's an incredible amount of skill that has surfaced and been attracted to this, where, you know, you get this paradox of skill where returns kind of start to get closer together because everyone is so good. If you could find to use the fishing analogy that Munger's used in the past on this exact topic, go where the fish are, but also where the fishermen might not be particularly adept, that your other competitive fishermen. So, you know, I think there's some interesting arguments to be made about China as a place to explore.
Over the last few years,
Charlie should buy weed stocks. Also, the person that said 3 to 5% stupid, that's fine. You can have different risk parameters than I do. You're stupid. Next.
There's been an increase in the retail participation in the States over the last 2 years or so, probably, you know, by virtue of Robinhood. So they got their S1 out. I know Bill's taking a look at the S1. You got any? I think I said I wouldn't talk about this. Sorry, mate.
No,
just came to mind.
Yeah, I'm sure it just popped into your head.
bear trap.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's see. So they settled with my family, which is preface one. And within the context of a horrible, horrible situation, I think that they made it less horrible by doing so. So I'm going to be somewhat reserved in what I say. On the other hand, I think if you look through that company's, how many people participate in options in crypto on that platform versus the other platforms, and the growth in those people's participation over the last year, I remain unconvinced that anything that I've said is incorrect about the platform, especially when they cite monetizable daily active users. Like, get the fuck out of here in a financial product. And secondly, I think there's a lot of risk on that book. I don't know how you'd underwrite it. That's sort of a fun thing that I was thinking about, is like, you know, how do you figure out what is actually sustainable and what they're probably going to grow off of when you have that kind of a ramp over the last year? Try to pull up the numbers real quick.
One of the things that really stood out to me is the average revenue per user, the ARPU, has been growing pretty significantly in the period, like in the 5 years or so that they post. It's more than doubled. I don't know if that's like a cyclical thing. That's what happens as markets go up. People trade more and they're much more speculative than they would be otherwise, or if that's like they're just getting better at extracting money out of
their clients. I think it's both. But like, isn't it a little offensive to see a financial firm talk about monetizable daily active users and cite ARPU? I know, but this isn't a fucking advertising firm. Like, I just kind of wish that people would be more honest about what it is.
I think they are being very honest, aren't they? They're being very explicit about what they're doing.
Yeah.
They are who we thought they were.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's fair.
Yeah, somebody pointed out a surprising chunk of their revenue was from trading dog money.
Yeah, 5%.
What have we come to?
Oof. Markets are capable of very, very silly behavior.
It is an interesting time, and one that is hard to argue is still inning three.
What inning are we in? Let's hear it.
Dude, I don't know. But on the other hand,
Dog Money didn't jump the shark, but Dog Money not enough for you.
Well, no, that's plenty. I guess what I'd just say is I'm not sure. I mean, we're very financial markets focused in the profession. The underlying economy, I mean, I've done a fair amount of traveling in the past month, and New York was popping, Chicago was popping, and Middle Tennessee was popping. So, like, fundamentally, things feel much better to me than I thought that they would. But, you know,
a couple of Manhattans will do that for you.
No, man. I mean, Tennessee, I didn't drink at all. And, well, that's kind of a lie. One night I did. But, they were packed in like sardines. Now we can have a discussion about vaccination rates and what that leads to, but it was very, very, very busy.
We just got demonetized again.
Yeah, we're just like the trifecta of demonetization.
I'm looking at ARPU. Yeah, ARPU from 2017 to 2020 has grown from $37 a user to $109 a user. That's a lot of growth.
That's a lot of call options.
But then, dude, so this is what's tough,
for,
right?
For a free platform. Cost you nothing to trade.
It's free.
So fucking offensive. Anyway, 2018, $66.50 per user. 2019, $65.70 per user. And then 2020 is $108. Trailing 3 months is $137.
Yeah, that was the number that I saw. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know how you underwrite that. Like, that's kind of... from a financial perspective, that's kind of the fun part of this all.
Do they give you enough to sort of unpack how they're driving that? Is that people trading more and more, or them getting more money from what they're doing? It must be people trading more, right? The trading is blowing up on that platform.
I mean, to be fair, their assets under custody have exploded a lot, and I haven't done assets per user because honestly, I can only look at this for so long before I get too angry. But that's
there we are.
Yeah, well, it's true. So I don't know. It's an interesting S1 to read.
Let me do a little segue into my bit, and then we can chew on Jake's veggies.
Real quick, did you notice that the risk section in that is yellow?
I didn't know. What does that indicate?
I think it says, here's risk. Just, you know, maybe tap the brakes or just pump on the gas. Either way, get through before we say stop.
The yellow probably like strains your eyes to read it. So you move through faster and then don't even bother reading it.
Yeah. That's the trick with the all caps, right? It's all caps. So it looks like it's really, you got to really pay attention to this part. And then you try and read it and you can't read it.
Is that why lawyers do that? They make the terms of service and all caps. So you're like, fuck it. I'm just going to the bottom.
Most people don't read all caps
because it's hard to read.
Yeah. And it's easy to tell people like, no, look at how it's capitalized.
We made it stand out.
Yeah, that's right.
We bolded it. And we put it in italics as well.
Toby be knowing the game.
Oh my God. Wish we would treat each other better than this.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard though, as a lawyer, like you're just like, how do I get people to pay attention to this part? I'll put it in all caps. And then, you know, the sales guy looks at it and he's like, that's really hard to read. Keep it in all caps. Something like that.
Let's turn these brains right off.
Yeah.
Speaking of turning your brain off, let's just do my little contribution. So GMO noted value shop have been crying about how expensive the market is almost as long as I have. No, probably longer than I have, about the same period of time. No, there are no winners here. They point out that, you know, we had this value guys really long period of time where nothing really worked. Had this brief kind of rally. I don't know when that started, the reopening trade, like September last year, ran through to about March. 6 months is a long time in this game. That's fruit fly kind of value. But then more recently since March, so for the last quarter, we've backed off quite a lot. And they say 742 basis points, which is 7.5%. That's quite a lot of a long way to fall back. And they say...
Was that just flat though? And the other things went back up? Is that... Or do you happen to know? Because that kind of matters a little bit too.
Yeah, so I think I can talk to ARK because that's one I track pretty closely, the ARKK. That bottomed under $100 and I think it was back, it might have got back to 130. And I don't think that value backed off much through there. I think it was just flat. So it's probably, you're right, it's probably more a bounce in the growthier names than it was. And that was on the back of the growthier names getting, you know, they were 30 to 50%. Yeah.
Yeah. Stuff like Snow's up, I think I saw 40% and Spotify ripped and
from this sort of recent bottom. Base. Yeah.
My beloved Twitter's ripped.
So GMO's got this piece out, value versus growth reversals. And the headline is basically the best 3 year period for value versus growth, which was February 2003 to February 2003. Value suffered some of its worst drawdown through that period. And they've got this nice chart where they show like 4 of the worst 10 occurred during that 3 year period. So I guess the message that they're saying is just that when it turns around, then there's this volatility, there's volatility in both directions, up and down. So you shouldn't necessarily get discouraged. But I think that the much, much broader takeaway from that is in the short term, markets are just completely unpredictable and you're going to see a lot of moves up and down that make no sense whatsoever. And it's because they don't mean anything. It's because they're just completely noise. So ultimately, I think ultimately, and I don't know when that ultimately comes in, kingdom come, like the heat death of the universe value starts outperforming again. But I think ultimately it does sort of track along with fundamentals. And I feel the fundamentals, I think, for value portfolios still look really good.
So you're telling me there's a chance.
There's a chance. There's a chance, baby.
I read you.
I think we turned around. I think we turned around at the end of June. I think we've been doing a little bit better the last 2 weeks.
I don't know.
What I mean, do you think just for your mental health? And I'm saying
I should take a step back. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I was gonna say your mental health, the more broader you, but also you, Tobias Carlisle. That maybe like following every single one of these ups and downs might be just a good way to wear a fella out.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what are you going to do if you're Toby? It's like his job, right? He's got 2 value ETFs. So what else are you going to follow? You should write a book about the invincible investor. That's what you should do.
I think that you... What I have noticed
is Churchill in it.
No, he is now.
Okay.
The Churchill quote would be something like, "If you're going through hell, keep going," which is a great quote, and that's a good thing to bear in mind. But one thing that I have observed, like if you have there's lots of different variations of this, but if you have a strategy that you know works over a very long period of time, it's just astonishing the number of very long drawdowns that you go through in that. And Wes has got a version of it. Wes Gray at Alpha Architects got a version where he says, God runs a portfolio, so God has perfect foresight. And there are still periods of time where God's down 90% and trailing like 90% of his peers and gets fired over a 3 year period. So it's a tough game. There's a lot of randomness in it.
Indeed.
God should have been a trader and not an investor in that little thing.
God should have known better.
Yeah, that's right.
He had the perfect foresight.
Yeah, he'd know that he's going to get fired. I'm going to take this up with Wes. I got some problems with how he framed this.
What's the problem?
God should have been a traitor in his example. I actually do like how he framed that quite a bit. I'm just being a smartass. ARK, I didn't realize that the drawdown was like 130 to 30. That's not small.
The drawdown was like 156 to under 90, wasn't it? I mean, to under 100.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if I can get some hocus pocus Fibonacci sequence on this thing real quick. Really bring the value analysis to peak analysis here. No, come on. It occurs in nature, Jake. You should like it.
I know.
The Fibonacci sequences.
Yeah.
Is that the golden ratio? What's Fibonacci?
No, Fibonacci, you've never seen like Fibonacci fans or like certain drawdowns. Here, boom, I just drew one. Yeah, it was about a 50% drawdown from peak to trough, from the very bottom in like in April. You got to get up on your technicals, Toby. That's what you should do. Spend your time with technical analysis.
There's so many to choose from. I mean, it's especially when I'm using all of the different value ratios, right? So
there's value ratios
on the screen. That's where you went wrong right there.
Hear me out. Value ratios plus dojis and candlesticks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how to use them, though.
We got time. We'll teach you.
Let's get some veggies.
All right. Let's move on before this devolves to even worse.
People are just switching off in droves.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying this. This is fun. I missed you guys.
Probably when we start talking Fibonacci, people are just like, oh, hang on. Yeah. Now it's interesting.
Birdie used technicals for his entries.
Yeah.
I mean, be a value guy through 2000 to 2007. Doesn't matter what you use. How did you choose what to go into? I picked the letters of the alphabet. Price to book and the letters of the alphabet.
That'd be a winning strategy. All right. So shout out to Otto Forrester, who DM'd me this little idea as a veggie segment. Much appreciated, sir. What we're going to be talking about is this French culinary concept called mise en place. And what it means effectively in English is put in place or everything in its place. And really, it's sort of a mindset and a practice and a process to allow a chef to be super efficient and even perhaps achieve a bit of a flow state while they are cooking. So let's walk through what the steps are to achieve mise en place. And step one is you read the entire recipe. Okay, that's fairly straightforward. Step two, you prepare your workspace and you clean it as much as you can, organize it so you know where every one of your tools are. Step three is you prepare all of your equipment. You clean it and make sure it's all functional. Step four is you gather all your ingredients and you put them into like prep cups. And step five is, you prep the ingredients such that like you chop all your vegetables, you put all of the, let's say we're making an omelet, you put all your cheese into a little, like measured it out into a bowl and then you place everything at hand right where where it is. Maybe even in the same place regularly. And then the final step is really concentrating on the cooking process because you know that you have all of the little details are sorted out ahead of time before the rush of actually cooking when there's a timing element to all cooking, right? Like the amount of energy that the food absorbs over a given time period, the amount of work done on it really can have big impact on how does the final food output look like. So the whole point is to make this process smooth, more consistent results, save time actually at the end, less surprises, save space because you're well organized on your table. And then, achieve that flow state and actually make your cooking more enjoyable. Well, shit, if that doesn't sound like what you would sort of want your investment process to look like as well, like, I think this is actually something kind of profound here. So, imagine having your bowl of chopped veggies right where it is, since we're doing a veggie segment. Your cheese, your diced meats, your eggs already scrambled, and you have it all ready to go on the table. And then the order comes in that says, hey, we need 10 omelets. Okay, well, I'm ready to bang those out right now because I have them all at hand. I know where everything is and I can really focus on the process. Whereas if I'm standing there and then the orders come in and then I have to go do all those little things and maybe I'm trying to chop up the veggies and while I'm also like scrambling eggs and like it just can turn into a mess. And you could see how you're creating interconnectedness within the system, like we've talked about, like how errors propagate. and if you think about it, isn't this exactly what Buffett does? He is reading all the time about different businesses, their 10Ks, industrial publications. Like, how does a company fit into its competitive landscape, its ecosystem? What are its advantages? And he's got a list in his head of companies I think that he would be pretty happy to own. And he's got a pretty good idea what he would pay, where he would generate an adequate return over the time period of his ownership. And is that much different than having your bowl of eggs already pre-scrambled, your cheese ready to throw in, right? And so then when the order comes in, when someone approaches him, when Mr. Market offers him a price for that company, this is why he can say in 15 minutes whether he's interested in buying the company and have a deal and a handshake done in that short amount of time. It's because he's had a mise en place approach to being ready for when the opportunity shows up. Like having all that cash is not much different than a bunch of cheese sitting in a bowl ready to go. So, you know, I think there's something profound there for us as investors to think about doing a lot of the work ahead of time rather than waiting and then scrambling to try to get caught up. Pardon the pun there. So yeah, I don't know. What do you guys think about that? I mean, is this...
What's your desk look like, JT? You got a tidy desk. Tidy desk, tidy mind.
Yeah, it's relatively tidy. I've got a little bit of, it's not OCD, but I'm a little bit anally retentive.
It's your mise en place.
Yeah.
Your desktop of your computer, tidy as well, know where everything is.
Pretty much. Yeah, there's portions of where some things go.
You got some junk, some miscellaneous folders.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. There's miscellaneous, but for the most part, things have a place where they go.
Do you keep a list of... You know, so I have an idea of these are the most profitable companies in the market by just in absolute terms, like gross profitability, and then on various ratios like gross margins and gross profitability on total assets and things like that. So I have a rough idea like where the profit in the entire economy is going, and then
it's all ads. Simpson.
It's a lot of ads. Yeah, Walmart is up in there too. Facebook, of course, is up there. You can run a simple cut on that. I mean, this is sort of one of the things that I struggle with. Like, where's the appropriate place to cut?
Yeah.
Because you know the valuation, like, what's the appropriate what is too much to pay for these things? And the answer over the last decade has been
there's no
anytime you try and like put a cut in there. So that's kind of I think that's a great approach. I 100% agree with that. And I like it a lot.
Bill, what do you think?
I think this is the reason that studying quality businesses as defined as those that don't have as much operating volatility makes a lot of sense, because you can actually build a model that's reliably bankable. And then like with a lot of them, I don't really expect them to trade at, you know, as deep of a discount as some of the more inherently fluctuating businesses, because they are somewhat more predictable. And, you know, that's within a context of, you can say, well, the world is inherently unpredictable, and that's fine. But like, I think COVID pretty much showed, you know, I was in airlines because they were relatively cheaper and I thought that it was a good bet. Well, they didn't exactly protect me from that particular downturn. Now, something that Jeremy Raper had said to me, which I think is worth pondering. Shout out to Ross Gerber for your great airline take out there. But you know, it could have been a internet-based virus that shut down everything. There's nothing in the world that says it must have been a physical virus. And had it been an electrical one, all this narrative about SaaS is so
robust,
maybe would have, you know, maybe we're resulting like a little bit too much on that.
You could make the argument that if the universe was just, it would have been an electrical one and not based on who was hurt and who had the capacity to suffer the most. It probably would have been more fair to have the average person.
You'd have more human toll. But regardless, I kind of understand what you're saying.
You mean it would have been more human toll from an online virus?
Yeah. Well, like if, well, okay. From,
or
yes,
from a fucking
okay,
EMT
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. No, I don't mean that. Yes, I was confused. I was going by the intersection of two things, a pandemic plus an electric virus, as opposed to one or the other. Yeah. That would have not been good. You're welcome. Come to here for the best takes.
It's kind of amazing, really, that like I just feel like it's a pretty fragile system, isn't it? Like it's kind of amazing that we haven't had it. Like don't we just like one little sun electromagnetic pulse from the sun and we're all in a little bit of trouble, aren't we?
I have no idea, but I do think that that's a reasonable thing.
Oh, thanks for considering it.
You're welcome. I don't fucking know. Just trying to figure out what I can know. But
well, they do shut down, like especially in northern latitudes, that they will be greater impact from sunbursts like that. And there are some measurements that we have of, so they'll shut down power grids sometimes in preparation for that, so that it doesn't fry the electrical system. Like Canada has some protocols for that, but anyway,
not the US.
So long story short, I like what you're saying. I just think it's easier to be prepared when you're underwriting some of these like higher quality businesses where the underlying business doesn't fluctuate as much, but that may be resulting.
Yeah. If you had asked, like, what's the biggest threat? Like,
I don't mean to cut you off, Toby. I know I just did, but what I'm thinking about right now is like you said when SPGI and IHS were merging, you were like, this is cheap. SPGI, you know, maybe not absolutely cheap, but you were like, look at where this is trading. Look at where it normally trades. Look at what companies like this trade. This is cheap. And you were dead right. And I think that on those kind of companies, you can do stuff like that with a little bit more conviction because you kind of have more confidence in where it's going.
The only thing about SPGI, and you know, there's a few in their fact set, something else in there at the moment just escaped me. I think they all trade at a slight discount to the market, and I don't know why. And I think it's possibly that everybody knows that they're going to be cyclical. If we go down the other side of a crash, these things are going to pull back a little bit. And that's certainly what SPGI did in 2008, 2009. It does come off kind of in line with the market. But it's a great business. Like the returns on equity are just monstrous, and it's Standard & Poor's. Like it's been around, the index has been around since 1850. Like it's got pretty good longevity. I like it as a business. I think that the issue was that they tried to pay an absolute, you know, monster price for IHS. So they paid a full price for it. I don't know if it was too much, but there was a very full price for it. And I think that a lot of people were just like, well, if they're going to spend money like that, I'm out.
Yeah. I mean, that's a fair, you have to probably discount intrinsic value if the cash that this amazing business is producing perhaps does not end up back in your pocket as the owner, right? Like that's the important equation. So if it's going to be frittered away, I'm not saying that this deal necessarily was that, because I don't really know well enough to say.
But, neither do I.
But if that is the case, then yeah, I mean, the intrinsic value is pinched because of that.
Mike Mitchell's in our comment section.
Yeah. I mean, dude, they got, I don't know, you got debt maturities that are way out there. They don't come due until 2025 and some are 2051 plus. I think you start to get stuff like that, you can pay a stiff multiple because
I think it's
cash flow is not that unencumbered for a while.
And I don't think you are paying a stiff multiple for it. I think you're paying a whatever the opposite of that is.
Last a real limp one. Some of your return probably depends on how much they can roll the debt versus pay it down. But I don't think right now rolling debt is the biggest concern on anyone's mind.
No one ever thinks that until,
well, until it's been a while. You just flip it to the Fed.
Yeah, it's fair.
I've been tracking fear and greed.
And you want to get mad at the CCP.
I'm just playing the game that I see as the rules are. I'm not saying it's the game as it should be divined.
By the way, I was thinking, what if Charlie was Rudy Havenstein this whole time?
That would be funny.
Shout out to Rudy.
Yeah, I love that guy.
I'll tell you what, man, in a different way, I need a burner. I've been hopping on Spaces, and I'm getting called up too quick. Yesterday, I got into Matt Ball's space, and he called me up like immediately, and I didn't know what was going on. And he and I are kind of like communicating in the back channels of the Twitter machine. So I got on, and I'm like, dude, I got nothing to say to you. Like, you're a legend, whatever. And then I got off, and I felt like a complete idiot. So I'm going a burner.
I don't even
officially
know what that
be lurking
means. What is the? I don't know these mechanisms that you're discussing.
You got to get on Spaces, man. We got to do a space. We'll bring the fans on. They can ask questions. It'll be fun.
It'd be just like doing a YouTube live.
It'll be like just doing this. But
but it's different. You get people to talk. It's fun. I bet you guys would like it.
All right. I'll try it.
I'd like it.
Fear and Greed. I had a look at Fear and Greed over. I've just been tracking it just because I'm sort of interested tonight. It's amazing how much fear is in the market at the moment.
Really?
Yeah, it's where
you misspelled greed.
that's the strangest thing, right? It's obviously because it's kind of breaking the algorithm a little bit because we've been up so much and over the last 12 months, and we're just pulling back a tiny little bit. And so every single one of those ratios, which looks back about 12 months, says, oh, we're in, this is extreme greed, extreme fear. But it's like the one thing that really just does not break is the S&P 500 floating above its 200-day moving average. Like that sucker just does not go down.
I did see, yeah. I think it's TD Ameritrade has a investor sentiment kind of index. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that before.
No. Same idea.
Well, they aggregate all their trade data to see just like buys versus sells and like where is the general sentiment. And it tracks perfectly with the market. Like it, you know, S&P's up, sentiment's up. It's down, it's down.
But that kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Isn't that how these things work?
Sure. Yeah. Of course.
I need a leading indicator. Tell me when it's all going to roll over.
Yeah, it's not.
I don't need one that's going exactly at the time.
Well, that's kind of why I like Fear and Greed, because it's a little bit, it's a contra, right? When there's extreme greed in the market, you're probably going to get a better chance, another bite of the cherry. And when there's extreme fear in the market, it might be a good time to go shopping. But it does break down. And I noticed it if you go back to 2013 and you look at it in 2013, I think you got to use the Wayback Machine to do it. But 2013 was one of those years where the market was just up 30% over the course of the year, and it did it at a 45 degree angle. It just went straight up, but there was still a time to buy, like in the middle of the year, where it wobbled like briefly. And by the definition of this little metric, that was like extreme fear for the year. So it wasn't the best time to buy in the year, but it wasn't a bad time to buy either. It just kept on rocketing up. Maybe we're just in one of those times right now.
Area Value Man says buy the dips.
I got another metric too. I like, just as we were talking before, you know, my list of the best stuff in the market where I've got like the cutoff. And this is the thing I struggle with, like what's an appropriate amount of money to pay for those? Because there's basically the more you're prepared to pay, the better you've done for a very long period of time here. And so whatever sensible kind of margin of safety you think you're using, you're probably making a mistake with that. And I don't know if that's just the way it's going to be forever and ever.
Disciplined buyer. I see where you went wrong.
That's your mistake. Like you should have paid up for it. It's worth paying up for these good stocks. Like, of course, in retrospect, that's the case. But I've just noticed that there are a very large number. There are an unusually large number of these companies available at a pretty good price on just about like whatever. If you put a cutoff at any given level, like say 1x the 10-year, 3x the 10-year, whatever your. So the yield on the 10-year. Being equivalent to some sort of free cash flow yield on the company that you're buying, if you're thinking about it in those terms. I don't know where the appropriate point is to draw that line, but in either case, you can kind of look back over the last 20 years and see when there are more companies available, you tend to do better. When there are more companies available above one of those thresholds, you do better. When there are fewer companies available at one of those thresholds, you do worse. Probably as you'd expect, that indicates that the market's more or less expensive than it would otherwise be. We're currently at a point where it's saying we're in like the 10 or 15% best opportunities to buy.
Really?
Dang.
Which makes no sense to me. That's the thing that's breaking my head the most at the moment. I don't really.
There's a lot of value out there, man. I mean, I'm going to say something that's under-researched and do not fucking listen to me. But if you want to do the work and write me, I would greatly appreciate it. Like CVS looks pretty interesting. I was checking that out today. I read a pitch on United Healthcare that I thought was very good. Like IAC, that's like tough for me to really get behind Angie's because I think there's like an adverse selection problem there, but
what's that?
I just think that like fundamentally the really good trades people operate on word of mouth. And like, so when I was in flooring, Angie's List was like the gold standard of leads. Okay. You would get an Angie's List lead and you could walk in. And it would be a non-competitive bid. It would be a nice customer. They already pre-qualified you. And like, you could just say it wasn't competitive. The other business was ServiceMaster, which was like a lead gen biz. which you would get three leads immediately. You'd have to get on the phone. I'd be calling people at like fucking midnight trying to book, you know, because you get charged $50 a lead. So when I'd be sleeping and it would ding my phone and I'd wake up and call because I'd know that they were thinking about the product at the time.
So someone had literally entered it into the system and it had sent you the lead at midnight.
Oh yeah, dude. I was a rabid dog with leads because that stuff costs money. But then your close rates are like really shitty and the customers are on average were like super cost centric. And my perception of what the business has moved to is much closer to my negative perception of the lead gen service than it is what Angie's List used to be. On the other hand, you know, if they actually can automate like what a kitchen remodel should cost and they actually can quote you the material cost pretty well and you can get a fixed product with some sort of execution certainty, like that is a really, really hard problem to solve. If they could get 5 to 10% of the market, like that's going to be worth a lot of money, if nothing else, just from the certainty, because it's going to be a very, very hard marketplace to displace. Very hard. I just don't know that I think they can get there.
If you need a handyman or anything like that, it's always they just come and go because that's the nature of the business. So if you have a relationship with something like one of those places, that's of course you're just going to keep on going back to that. It should be a pretty good business run.
Yeah, I think so. The question is, are the good handymen coming there to fill their day? And, you know, maybe a handyman can, but would a plumber, like, I don't know. Good plumbers are like gold. You don't just like hand them off. Painters too. I don't know. That's the hard part for me on that particular idea.
So getting the good guys into the marketplace is the difficult thing.
That's right. But if they can do it, it's going to be worth a shit ton.
And it's very hard to know whether anybody's any good at anything, right? When you're just desperate to find somebody. So maybe that does solve that problem. They get some sort of rating system in there. I don't know. I haven't used it.
Yeah. Well, that's how it used to be. So back in the day, like you'd have members and they'd give you reviews and the reviews were gold. Like they weren't gamed at all. And that's why you could walk in. Now? I think it's closer to game.
Yeah.
Sorry to the IAC longs. I'm not trying to like take shots at you.
You want to take some questions from the crowd? I saw one from Samson. Is the 52-week Lowe's List a good place to go shopping? It's typically not probabilistically because it's things with low momentum, definitionally the lowest momentum in the market. If that's one of the things that you care about, you're batting against that average, which, you know, momentum has like a 12-month, 15-month kind of like follow-on period. So 52-week lows would be like there's probably 3 months of pain in buying off the 52-week lows list. You might be better off buying off if you can find something cheap on the 52-week highs list, that might be a better place. But then you can probably safely ignore momentum in there too if you're thinking about holding for a long period of time and you're looking at the fundamentals. But I wouldn't necessarily shop on the 52-week lows list either. It's just stuff that's down a lot over the last 52 weeks. It's not necessarily cheap.
I think the game's a little more complex than that. I mean, I'd look everywhere.
But you've got a finite number of places in your mise en place, right? You've got a fixed amount of room. Like, what are you using to drive? Do you want Do you want stuff that's down a lot over the last year, or do you want stuff that's cheap? Because they're not the same thing.
Right.
Yeah. Arguably they should be, but that doesn't mean they are, right? Well, Gainer has said in the past that he started off on the 52-week low list, and now he likes to start on the 52-week high list. I think that's not the craziest thing.
But I don't think you should worry about it at all.
Yeah, I think it depends on your strategy, right? I think
high's better than lows.
Yeah.
High's better than lows, but high's not any more helpful necessarily if you're a value guy. You should be looking at the cheapest stuff, looking at the stuff that you think is the best.
Well, as someone who hasn't had a direct conversation with Tom in a very long time, and the only one that I had was in a room full of people, I will say that I think the reason that he likes the 52-week high list is it enables clues to study businesses that are starting to fire on all cylinders or are firing on all cylinders. And given the strategy I think he runs, that will help him wait for the right time to buy. because he's looking for companies to study, not things to buy today.
Yeah, fair enough. But it's also like, that's what does the rest of the market think about what this thing is doing?
Yeah.
If you're a good enough investor, you go in and have a look at the fundamentals yourself and see what's this thing done over a series of 10 Qs and Ks.
Well, it's all just like where to start, right? It's not. Looking at a list is not due diligence. I think we can all agree on that.
That's a start, but that's kind of my point. Like, just why would you start on that list? You start on something that makes more sense for your own investment strategy.
Yeah.
And why not, you could start with the A's. Like, that would be just as helpful as starting on the 52-week highs list, wouldn't it?
I suppose.
Any good oil ideas?
No. Why would you come to here for that? We've demonstrated no competence on that.
I don't think anybody's got any competence in that. What about the pipelines?
I don't know. I have no idea worth sharing.
I think it will take black to get to green.
Huh?
You need energy up before it starts working.
No. As a species, to get to all this green energy, I think it will require black petrochemical energy to get us there.
Yeah. Concur.
Do you guys know anything about NASPA's process? I have a podcast on it with Adrian Saville, who's a South African value investor who's quite knowledgeable about it and has a good discussion of it, if you want to see that. I don't know that we necessarily have anything.
I do. Hit up at Panda Value on the Twitter machine. He is the OG of holdcos, loves them. If you know of good holdcos, talk to him about them. He will be the who you need to talk to.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he loves holdcos and he's pretty sharp.
Got a question here. I trade to profit from potential hackers attack against grid-like companies. So you guys remember the ETF hack? Got its start when the Sony hack, that was it blew up to like an $800 million ETF when Sony got hacked, and I think that the assets are pretty sticky. And then it's had this like sordid history where it kind of got stolen by some of the guys running it, and in a manner of speaking. I don't know, man. I don't know about that sort of stuff. Like, there's no. You could just, if stuff gets hacked, like if it's important enough and the whole market goes down, then you just get long the VIX or get short the market. Whether you're going to play specifically, like you could go and play and hack, but I look at the contents of those things. Like, it's like the contents of any of these thematic ETFs. There's always stuff like why is Caterpillar in ARK space ETF? I got no idea. They've got satellites or something. I don't know.
Are you going to need cat? You know, if you're going to terraform Mars, you're going to need some heavy equipment.
True.
Good point.
I don't know.
And sound. Math checks out.
Yeah, that's just math.
I'd say on hack, the only strong opinion that I have is cybersecurity doesn't matter how effective it is. It just matters whether or not they can sell the market on believing that it's useful.
Yeah.
Apparently, you can't hardly get cyber insurance for any reasonable price. I've read. I don't know if that's true or not, but
it's because my buddy in cybersecurity tells me that it doesn't do anything except for his phishing business, which you could argue he's got some motivated reasoning there. But I mean, he's like, look at the results of all these cybersecurity firms. They don't stop anything.
Do you think this will be a potential listed reason for why their government could crack down on cryptocurrencies? Like, we can't have these outlets for, you know, hostage basically situations, cyber hostage.
Yeah, what could they do to crack down on it?
I don't know, just try to police more of the on and off ramps, I guess.
Because was it a hack of the Texas grid? Is that what happened? Or the recent one where they it was quite a big ransom payment, and then they were able to track the wallet and they got half of the money and the guys who did it.
Oh, was that the East Coast pipeline?
Was it East Coast?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was recently. I don't know. I don't know that that's what happened. I've been on vacation.
You've been hacking your liver.
Yeah, that's over now, but it was fun.
When one of the satellites was going to fall out of space when I was a kid, when I was in middle school, I think, one of the guys at middle school sold a insurance that he would pay. I can't remember the amount of money. It might have been $1,000, which was just like an astronomically large amount of money at that time, if you got hit by the satellite when it came out of space. But in addition, you had to be wearing this like paper hat that he made on your head.
What? Hey, which, I have so, respect.
This guy's
for
a
him.
Genius.
Isn't that kind of brilliant? So people were marketing his isn't little that, insurance venture.
Is that Lemonade's business model? No, I'm just kidding. Ooh.
So that's hurtful. I will sell cyber security insurance, but you got to be wearing the paper hat when it happens.
Tinfoil hat. The tinfoil hat. Now, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I'll ship the tinfoil hat. On that note, folks, that's it. It's been fun.
It's a good one to end on.
We ground to a halt. Just end it now, mercifully.
Yes, exactly.
Thanks, folks. We'll be back. Shake it up, stop when the clock hits 13. Sing 1, 2, 3, 4. Cause. No one can do it like we do it, like we do it, like we do it. Cause no one can do it like we do it, like we do it, like we do it.